Good morning. May it please the court. Counsel, my name is Jorge Rangel from Corpus Christi, and I, along with Mike Hatchell from Tyler, are here representing Coller Hines Publishing Company in connection with this matter. The issue before the court insofar as the points that the points in the writ that were granted relate to the test which is to be employed in a predatory pricing case under the Texas Free Enterprise and Antitrust Act. This is a matter of first impression for this court. It is our position that the court below committed errors in affirming the trial court's judgment against the defendant because there was no evidence that the Caller Times price, the advertisement in question, below any appropriate measure of cost. And secondly, because the court below failed to adopt the Fifth Circuit test in connection with a predatory pricing case. In evaluating these issues and looking at the predatory pricing test, I think it is important for the court to construct the act by looking at the purposes of the act. Under Section 15.04, it is clear that the purpose of the Texas Free Enterprise and Antitrust Act was and is to promote competition and to give to the consumers the benefit of that competition. Second, under 15.04, it is clear that the legislature mandated that in construing and interpreting the act, comparable federal judicial interpretations should be looked at. There is a body of law out there because the Texas Free Enterprise and Antitrust Act is patterned after the federal antitrust laws. So it is important to keep that in mind because the decision below, the opinions by the majority, ignores these two fundamental purposes in the act. It ignores the purpose that this act is designed to promote competition to benefit consumers. In fact, the decision by the court below and the test that it adopted and the analysis that followed, in fact, harms consumers, does not promote competition. And secondly, even under the test that the court below adopted, the court itself, in its analysis, is not loyal to that test. What is that body of law? The United States Supreme Court has made it clear in the last three times that it has addressed this issue that even though there is some debate as to the precise definition of predatory pricing, the Supreme Court has said that in order to establish predatory pricing, there must be evidence that the price is below some appropriate measure of cost. The United States Supreme Court has said that as recently as last year in the ARCO case.
Counsel, yes, sir. In every small community in Texas where there is a Walmart store, there are 12 to 20 small local businesses that are put out of business. Would, under the Court of Appeals decision, would all of these businesses have a cause of action against Walmart if they can show that they are using loss leaders?
If, in fact, under the test by the court, that if the Walmart prices are above their average variable cost, if under the test by the court it's possible that they could come in and say that, because the Court of Appeals is using a test which really does not address costs. It is using a test that relies on profit margins.
Well, it's using a test that considers costs but doesn't find them to be the final word, right?
It really does not consider costs in this sense, because when you're talking about price competition, you're looking at the cost that is involved in producing that additional unit. You're looking at variable costs. You're looking at incremental costs. The profit margin test the court developed below is really just a retrospective look at how an enterprise has done sales and expenses. It tells you nothing about the costs that are involved in producing that particular unit. So if you have an enterprise with a 10% profit margin, that means that that enterprise is not going to be able to lower its prices below 10%, even though something may have happened. Let's say they had a cost savings in a particular quarter. The airline industry, if fuel costs have skyrocketed because of international situation during one quarter, then the costs go down the following quarter.
Well, does it say you can't lower the cost, or that lowering cost will be looked at along with other factors to determine whether the action is predatory in nature?
But the court adopts a test that involves subjective intent and the cost. And what the court is saying is if we have evidence that it's below average total cost with the intent, then we can look at it. But looking to the record in this case, the way that it arrived at average total cost by that profit margin is not supported by the record.
Looking to the record in this case, there's really nothing analogous in the record of this case to the Walmart example Judge Cook just gave you, is there?
Well, obviously we don't have any information with respect to the profit margin. We don't have any information.
Well, I'm not talking about the economic analysis. I'm talking about the specific claims that the caller Times went out and convinced individual advertising purchasers to drop their advertising in return for getting a special rate that was not available to other individuals. Isn't that essentially the claim here?
Well, the point is that dominant companies like Walmart and Caller Times have a right to compete vigorously in the marketplace, and that if the claim is that the price that is being charged is predatory, then you need to look to the test. And the way that you look to the test is by looking at whether or not the price that is being charged is below some appropriate measure of cost.
If an item is put on the shelf and not available to everybody, wouldn't that be predatory?
If we're talking about predatory pricing, it would not be predatory if price...
If an item was on the shelf and everybody comes in, but only certain people can buy that item at that lower cost. Is that not predatory?
Again, without addressing the price concept, I mean, the predatory pricing concept in the case requires a showing that the price that is being charged is below some appropriate measure of cost.
Isn't that situation covered by the Robinson patent?
That is.
That is a separate situation.
That's a separate situation, not under discrimination.
That is illegal.
Correct.
What viability does predatory pricing have apart from attempt to monopoly?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear the first part.
What viability does predatory pricing have apart from attempt to monopoly?
I don't believe I understand the question.
Why should predatory pricing be actionable unless the intent on the part of the predator is to attempt to monopolize the market?
Well, that's the key. I mean,
what relation does cost have to that?
The relationship to cost is that if a company is selling a product below its cost, then the only rational decision for that is that it's doing in order to affect competitors, so that if competition is removed, then later there'd be a probability that they could recoup that with higher prices. But that's why it is important to demonstrate that the price that's being charged is below some measure of cost.
But certainly, if one person has lower variable costs and is charging a price equal to its variable cost, another person has higher variable cost and to stay in competition has to charge below that cost, can't he do that for a period of time in order to survive?
Depend on the intent, depend on the circumstances.
So we're back to intent.
In terms of the circumstances, you still have to look at the prices being charged and the test that's being used.
Is not average variable cost a more accurate barometer than total cost?
Yes, and that's what the Fifth Circuit has adopted in the adjuster's case. And the main reason is that with average variable costs, you are looking at what the cost, what it costs the business person to produce that additional unit.
Incrementing unit.
Exactly.
Mike, could you clarify something for me? At one point, you seem to be arguing that subjective intent should not be a consideration at all. At another point, you seem to be saying that subjective intent should be a consideration, but only when the price falls below the actual market cost.
The ten,
you know, you can drop it below cost, and if the intent is not to be predatory, but to just unload some goods, that's okay. If you drop it below cost in a competitive atmosphere where you're attempting to control the market, then you can consider the intent. Is that what you're saying? That as long as it's above actual cost, the price is above actual cost, regardless of its impact on the market, you should not consider subjective intent?
I'm trying to track the reasoning and the language in the Fifth Circuit. Fifth Circuit has indicated that if you have pricing below average variable cost, then that will be predatory pricing under the Aretha Turner
test.
I'm sorry?
Per se.
Well, Aretha Turner is saying
regardless of your motive.
The Fifth Circuit is unwilling to say that it is completely per se. And there's a little fudge factor in there. But the fact remains is that...
So we have a fudge standard we're supposed to adopt.
Well, no,
right?
Your Honor, it's not a fudge standard. It's a standard that requires evidence of pricing below some measure of cost standard, some measure of cost. And getting back to the record in this case, I mean, that is our position, that here there is absolutely no evidence of pricing below any measure of cost. If I could just get the last one.
What are we to do with the Malcolm case in light of the Fifth Circuit's pronouncement that one panel cannot overrule another?
The court in Adjusters addressed the Malcolm decision, and I think it's important to note that the Adjusters case was denied on rehearing en banc, and the court in Adjusters is saying that the test that the Supreme that the Fifth Circuit has adopted the objective test.
Was any opinion written there, or was it just a request that was denied?
Request, no opinion.
So there's not technically any precedential value applied to that.
Later in time, and the fact that it addressed the Malcolm case and the reasoning in Malcolm.
Why isn't the approach that the Ninth Circuit has taken with reference to the Aretha test a preferable approach?
It's a combination of the subjective and the cost. The problem with relying on a test that incorporates the subjective intent is that it is difficult to interpret. I mean, if a businessman says, I want all the business that I can get, I want to sell all the products that I can sell, well, that's an intent to compete. At the same time, is that going to be construed as an intent to compete in a predatory manner? So, our position is that under whatever test, I mean, if you take the test, the Fifth Circuit, even if you take the test that the Court of Appeals adopted, where you combine subjective intent in the average, below average total cost, that test has not been met. The plaintiffs did not meet that because the plaintiffs tried this case on the theory that subjective intent alone would suffice. And that, no court has adopted that. And the Court of Appeals expressly says that every court that has adopted a test has adopted one that has an element of cost. So, on whatever test that this court would choose to adopt, the plaintiffs have not met that test. And I think that is significant because we're talking about price competition. And when you have price competition, that you're encouraging competitors to lower prices to benefit the consumer.
Do you agree that the Fifth Circuit standard called predatory pricing, is a minority position within the federal circuits, held principally by the Fifth Circuit and the Second Circuit.
To the extent that it does not incorporate the subjective intent described in the Ninth Circuit and the Eleventh Circuit, I would agree to some extent. But
what about the First Circuit? You have some First Circuit cases in your brief, but don't list them as a circuit that's adopted this test.
I don't have the case in front of me, Your Honor, but I'll be willing to
submit that. Some of Judge Breyer's writings.
I believe Judge Breyer also had the cost test involved in the way that it was developed there. But I'd be willing to submit a post-argument memorandum to address that.
You attached an article from head of the antitrust section chastising the Court of Appeals in this case for not following the Fifth Circuit, and your brief addresses that to some extent also. But in short, what the Court of Appeals attempted to do was to follow the majority rule to the extent it could be ascertained from the federal circuits, with the Fifth Circuit sitting squarely in the minority position among those circuits.
Well, what the court below said was that the Fifth Circuit was at one extreme,
right,
and that the Eleventh Circuit was at the other extreme. And what the court below attempted to do was to come up with a test that would combine both of them. And what we're saying, that even under the test that it established, when you look at the record, since there was no evidence of fixed costs, there was no evidence of variable costs, there was no evidence of output, the test could not have been met. Our position is that it's a policy decision for this court to determine what test is to be established for the benefit of practitioners in industry and in the state and for the consumers. But I think that under whatever test is adopted, the record here will not support the judgment for the plaintiff. I believe my time is
up. Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. Mm-hmm. The court is ready to hear argument from respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. Andy Vickery will present argument to respondent.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. I'm joined at counsel table this morning by my brother and law partner, Lanny Vickery, who tried this case with me, and by Mr. George Magel, who ran Wheels and Keels until it was put out of business.
Did your client, who's with you at the council table, was he formerly an employee of the Caller Times?
Yes, he was, Your Honor.
And were the customers that were solicited away from him, were they formerly customers of the Caller Times?
The customers that were solicited away from him were always, they were customers of the Caller Times before, during, and after Wheels and Keels was in operation, Judge Cook.
On the federal income tax returns filed by your client's business, did they ever show a taxable profit during any year of operation? Is that in the record?
I don't believe that's in the record, Your Honor. I don't believe the tax returns themselves were put in the record, and I don't believe they're before the court.
What does the record show?
Well, what the record shows, Your Honor, is that there was a dramatic growth in business from the time that Mr. Magel and Mr. Mock started Wheels and Keels. They increased circulation. They hustled. They got a bunch of individual ads. They also got some display ads. And as a result of that, their business was growing. It was growing dramatically.
Well,
that growth curtailed later.
The Public Bank, InBank, and a few others had dramatic growth, but it didn't mean that they were successful. Okay. Was there any evidence introduced that showed that they were making a profit?
Yes, there was, Your Honor. I can't address that. Unfortunately, that issue is not one of the issues that the court has granted the writ on, and so I frankly didn't review that portion of the record to answer your question exactly, but
well,
we proved the profits.
It's raised in the briefs, and the answer is, your answer is that the record does reflect that the plaintiffs in this case did make a profit at some point in time.
Yes, sir, I think that's correct. It was raised in the briefs, of course, because there were a number of points of error that were raised that the court did not grant writ on. The question before the court, quite frankly, is whether an admitted monopolist with jury findings to that effect can deliberately put a single competitor out of business, or is that a violation of the antitrust laws? And we submit most respectfully it is. Now, I would like to get, if I might, directly to the question asked by you, Chief Justice Phillips, concerning the Malcolm case, because I think there's considerable misapprehension or misconstruction of the Fifth Circuit law. The fact of the matter is that we are taught as lawyers to think the most recent authority is the most authoritative case authority. That's the way most courts work. That is not the way the Fifth Circuit works. The Fifth Circuit, as this court well knows, works in panels of three, except when it hears cases en banc. In the 70s, it grew to be the largest constitutional court in the history of this nation with 26 judges. And it has developed through a long period of time what is called the Law of the Circuit Doctrine. What the Law of the Circuit Doctrine means is that where one panel of that court decides an issue, then a subsequent panel may not deviate from that rule of law unless the en banc court deviates. Now that is significant because there are three cases and they are viewed sequentially. There is the American Excelsior case, or International Air. Some refer to it by one or the other. In that case, a panel of three judges consisting of Judge Morgan, Lewis R. Morgan from Georgia, Judge Elbert Tuttle from Georgia, and Judge John Godbow from Alabama, talk about, they view the case in its proper procedural context. The plaintiff had tried an intent case to the jury. They put on proof of subjective intent to show predatory pricing, and they failed. They lost. On appeal, the plaintiff said, we were entitled to judgment as a matter of law. And the issue before the court in American Excelsior was, what standard must a plaintiff in an antitrust case meet in order to be entitled to judgment as a matter of law? And the court there discussed in a couple of footnotes Arita and Turner's analysis and said that for a plaintiff to prevail as a matter of law, they must meet this objective standard. They did not negate the ruling that subjective intent was proper. Indeed, the court discussed at some length whether the trial court had erred in excluding certain evidence pertaining to subjective intent. Then comes Malcolm. Malcolm squarely holds that what differentiates predatory pricing from non-predatory pricing is the motive. Now, following Malcolm, there's a case that the defendant cited to the trial judge but have not cited since, called Roman Haas. It was the last federal case decided before the 83 amendments to the Texas Antitrust Act. It was written by Judge Bue down in Houston. And he squarely held that proof of predatory pricing could be made by either way, proof of subjective intent, proof of objective pricing below variable cost. Then comes...
None of those cases you referred to are binding on this court?
Absolutely not, Your Honor.
This court's free to adopt the test that seems most appropriate.
Absolutely.
And let me ask you, isn't it the motive of every competitor in the marketplace or otherwise to win?
I imagine it's the motive of every competitor in the marketplace, Your Honor, to succeed in competition.
If that means somebody does not fare as well or loses, that's inherent in the idea of competition. That's subjectively part of the analysis.
That's true, but the evil that is declared unlawful by the statute is a monopoly. And there are two components to monopoly. One is you have monopoly power in a relevant market, and issues one and two resolve that. And two is that you willfully acquire or maintain that power.
Well, because the subjective intent to win is part of every competitive situation, isn't it better then that the court adopt an objective standard rather than a subjective desire to win in the marketplace?
I don't think so at all, Your Honor. And the reason is that there's a notion that an objective standard is somehow better, that it must be better because it's objective, and there's a pejorative connotation associated with the word subjective. Well, an objective standard is not any better. It involves all sorts of conflicting, confusing claims. Look at the formulas in the brief filed by the amici on behalf of the defendant and appellant in this case. It's extremely confusing. You've got, what kind of expert do you have? You have an accountant on one hand or an economist on the other. They can't even get their nomenclature straight. One talks about marginal cost, the other talks about average variable cost. There's a whole debate as to what constitutes in each context an appropriate fixed cost versus incremental cost. Now, there is an article that came out in this month's Antitrust Journal. It's not cited in the briefs because it's current. It's called Predatory Pricing Analysis, a Practical Synthesis by a gentleman named Richard Rapp, and it's in the current issue of the Antitrust Law Journal, and it discusses newspapers in particular. In a newspaper context, the variable costs could be argued to be ink and newsprint. What that would mean as a practical matter is that a newspaper could drive a competitor out of business with absolute impunity because the ink and the newsprint are negligible. Those are negligible costs, and so it's a meaningless analysis.
But if the determining factor is intent, is there ever a business which competes with another that does not hope that the other goes out of business?
Your Honor, the intent we're talking about here is to drive the other out of business. We're differentiating between fighting fair and fighting unlawfully.
Doesn't every competitor hope and wish that what he does will drive everybody else out of the marketplace so that he will have it to himself? And that hope won't have a monopoly law in the first place.
Well, the point of having a monopoly law is to regulate people that either get dangerously close to achieving that level or, as in this case, arrive at that level.
But this is not a monopolization or attempted monopolized case. This is a predatory pricing case.
No, Your Honor, this is exactly a monopoly case and an attempted monopolization case.
So we don't need to worry about predatory pricing.
No. You have to worry about predatory pricing because that is one of the species of exclusionary conduct that will make a monopolist liable. If the monopolist either acquires or maintains his monopoly power through exclusionary conduct, one of which is predatory pricing, then he is liable for violating the statute.
And your case cannot stand on a monopolization or attempt to monopolize claim without the element of predatory pricing.
Oh, it certainly could, Your Honor. There's other exclusionary conduct that would support it, but the issue before this court now concerns only the predatory pricing issue. The exclusive dealing, the refusals to deal, there are all sorts of other predatory conduct that would render the monopolist available. I mean, let me read you from the charge that was agreed to by both parties. Mere possession of monopoly power, if lawfully acquired, does not violate the antitrust laws. But it is unlawful to use monopoly power, however lawfully acquired, to foreclose competition, to gain a competitive advantage, or to destroy a competitor. This case involves the use of monopoly power to destroy a competitor.
Counsel, what about the criticism of the petitioner that the profit margin standard the Court of Appeals reached is absolutely unworkable, has no accounting or economic significance, and will lead to massive uncertainty in the markets of the state?
Well, Your Honor, I think that, first of all, that I don't necessarily subscribe to the view that in adopting an appropriate standard, this court is wedded in any way to that two-tiered analysis. I don't think the court is. I think that you could elect to hold, as did Malcolm and Roman Haas, that proof could be made by either way.
Well,
you can go with Professor Sullivan.
I understand you have some problems with the court with this opinion too, but I was just asking about this one particular area of the opinion.
Your Honor, my view of it is this, that what the court has done is something analogous to what this court has done in the medical malpractice area, and that is establish a certain qualitative standard for proof that is necessary in order to get your case to the jury. You don't bring on expert proof in a medical malpractice case. Most of the time, you don't get your case to the jury. There are a few exceptions, but by and large, you have to have that proof. Now, that's a judge-made decision. The judge listens to the evidence and says, did you put on expert evidence about the standard of care? If you did, you get your case to the jury. If you don't, then you don't. The ultimate issue is resolved by a jury on the basis of all the evidence. That's really all the court has done. They have said as a qualitative matter that there has to be some objective indication. It really goes back to American Excelsior in the Fifth Circuit, that present revenues are sacrificed to garner future gains. And I didn't finish my thought about the Fifth Circuit. Let me say this. The Adjusters Court, which is the later court and attempts to distinguish Malcolm, says, well, Malcolm must have misunderstood American Excelsior, because in American Excelsior, this court had already joined the Aretha Turner camp. Well, that must have been news to the Malcolm court, because both Judge Tuttle and Judge Godbold, who were on the American Excelsior court, were on the Malcolm court. Surely those two judges knew what they had decided as part of a three-member panel in American Excelsior.
Counsel, did the jury questions break down the profits between past profits and future profits?
Yes, they did, Your Honor, and the award was entirely for past.
Okay, and what were the profits were for the three-year period, 85 through 87?
I believe that's correct, Your Honor.
Now, according to the brief, total gross revenues for those periods were $556,000. Is that correct?
I don't know, again, Your Honor, because that issue is not before the court. I didn't review that portion of the record in preparing for the argument.
Statement of Facts, page 183. Now, if we're using a 12% profit margin, that means that the profits could not have been more than $66,000, if that's correct.
Well, Your Honor, if we want to talk about damages, as the Court of Appeals pointed out, there are two measures. There's a before and after method, and there's a yardstick method. The yardstick that we use for that portion of the proof was their own records on the penny saver. They made about $100,000 a year on the penny saver, and for a 3.5-year period, we contend we lost, and the jury found we lost, $365,416.
Well, we use the 12% as a very important figure in one part of the case, but if we apply it to your gross revenue, we really get a totally different number.
But the 12% has nothing to do with our profit margin, Your Honor. That's the caller times profit margin. And the relevance of that testimony under the test fashioned by the Corpus Court from Judge Lynn's opinion in the 11th Circuit in the McGehee case, which frankly is the best recent judicial discussion of the overall issue, was a two-tiered analysis.
Counsel, this is a little subjective intent for me.
Okay, sir.
Decide, I'm not sure, and I suppose we'll hear a rebuttal, what their position really is on subjective intent. But as I recall, there's some evidence in the record that caller times people offered people lower prices, discount prices in the penny saver, if they would decline to advertise in Keels and Wheels, or Wheels and Keels.
Yes, sir.
Is there evidence on the other side that
oh, sure.
Wheels and Keels have said, hey, look, I'll give you a better price if you'll quit advertising the penny saver?
No, there's no evidence like that.
In other words, other things being equal as far as the cost factor is concerned, whatever formula, whether it's incremental, adjusted, averaged, or whatever terminology of measurement is used. At what point should intent, at what point should demonstrations of intent to put someone out of business be considered?
They should be considered in conjunction with the claim that there's a monopolization or an attempted monopolization, because an element of the cause of action for monopolization, there are two, monopoly power willfully acquired or used or maintained. With regard to attempts, there are two elements, an intent to achieve a monopoly and a dangerous probability of success. You know, moreover, under the Texas statute, the advantage of the Aretha Turner issue, and this gets back to...
Well, the intent of the Texas statute is to have competition in the marketplace for consumer benefit.
It is.
When you directly violate that intent by purposely maintaining monopoly and putting competitors out of business by design, you violate the intent of legislation.
No question about it. A monopoly is the very antithesis of competition.
Counsel, before your time expires, would you address the argument made by the petitioner that even under the test adopted by the Court of Appeals, the caller time, there is no evidence in the record that the caller time sold any advertising below its average total cost?
Sure, Your Honor. The fact of the matter is that...
Can you point the statement of facts? Or can you give me post-submission brief, citation to the statement of facts where you maintain there's evidence to support your claim?
Well, sure. The evidence is replete, Your Honor. I'll be glad to do it by post-submission brief if the court requires. But the record is replete with indications that they were offering half-price deals, and they were offering the Wheels and Keels customers. There's a very strong proof that they were available.
But that's not the question. The question is the test adopted by the Court of Appeals.
Right.
Has not been met is the argument. And I'm asking, inviting you to help us to see whether or not that's true.
Well, not on the intent, not on the subjective intent side, but on the objective.
Selling below the average total cost.
That's
the
right.
Evidence in the record is quite simply this, that the publisher and president of the Caller Times testified that their profit margin was 12%, give or take 5%. So they had a normal profit margin of 12%, give or take 5%. Therefore, if they're cutting half-price deals, they clearly are selling below total cost.
But total cost is completely different than marginal cost, average variable cost, incremental cost.
Yes, it is.
You're comparing apples and oranges.
Well, I was just answering Justice Gonzalez's question about the test adopted by the court below, Your Honor, which is total cost. And I wanted to get to your question, though, Your Honor, about isn't it better to go with objective evidence? Isn't it better to employ an objective standard? We can't do that in Texas because, and I don't want to sound like Doug Alexander here, but because the harmonization clause requires us to harmonize to the extent and only to the extent that there are parallel provisions. The damages provision of the Texas statute, Section 1521, has no parallel or analog in the federal jurisprudence. You see, in federal law, if you have a violation of the antitrust laws, treble damages are mandatory. Under Texas law, there is a statutory predicate, much like the insurance code or the DTPA, that the violation has to be willful or flagrant. Now, Professor Arita and Professor Turner say the advantage of our test is you don't have to muckety-muck around in all of this intent business. Courts don't have to litigate that issue. But in Texas, they'll always litigate that issue because that is the statutory predicate for treble damages. And more importantly, or additionally, in a monopolization or attempted monopolization, there's a scienter component in the underlying offense itself. So if scienter is part of the offense, it's ludicrous to suggest that proof of subjective intent is not acceptable proof.
Is this a case that relies exclusively on proof of subjective intent?
No, Your Honor, it's not. It is a case in which we proved, consistent with the earliest Fifth Circuit authority, American Excelsior, that the Caller Times had sacrificed present revenues for the purpose of garnering future gains. In other words, it is a case where a monopolist engaged in spot predation to drive a particular competitor out of business. There are lots of reasons why they would want to do that. The article I cited to the court addresses one of them, and that is to strew the lawn in front of them with corpses of people that tried to compete in order to establish a reputation as the biggest kid on the block.
Is there any doubt that they're the biggest kid on the block?
Oh, there's no doubt about that at all, Your Honor. There's an unchallenged jury finding that they had monopoly power. You know, the charge is, what's the relevant market? Did they have monopoly power? Yes. Did they willfully flagrantly acquire or maintain it? Yes. Did that cause damage? Yes. Did they attempt to monopolize it, properly defined? Yes. That caused damage? Yes.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
May it please the court. I have been assigned the role of rebutting in this case for 5 minutes because that will exhaust my knowledge of antitrust law, which, as the court's very thoughtful questions have illuminated, is a very complex issue, and we really sincerely appreciate the court's judicial fortitude in taking this case and attempting to write on what is basically a clean slate. As a housekeeping matter, let me answer Mr. Justice Hecht's question about the question of profit. Roman 3 SF 197199 is the testimony that Wheels and Keels never made a profit at any relevant time. The argument before the court has centered on the role of intent. And I think it's a good it's a good center, but I think the focus can get somewhat skewed because we need to define what sort of intent we're talking about. To answer Mr. Justice Gamage's question, and to somewhat echo by other questions, particularly Mr. Justice Doggett, this is purely an intent case. They told the trial court that this was purely an intent case. They are not going to try this case on economic data. What intent are we talking about, though, in the test and the role that it plays in the test that the court adopts? Is it an intent to drive a competitor out of business with sharp prices, or is it what all of the circuits have defined is an intent to commit the antitrust injury of driving a competitor out of business for the sole purpose of being able to dominate the market and raise my prices at a later time? Let me give you an example. Assume that I have an enormous inventory that I just can't sell. I want to get rid of that to at least minimize my losses. I sell those to the public at a loss. The beneficiary of the Texas Act gets the benefit of that. It is not my intent to drive my competitors out with this price. It is simply my intent to make myself economically healthy. I have sold them below my cost, but my intent is not to commit an antitrust injury. There is where the role of intent comes in. Because you can see that the jury could look at my intent in this instance, even though I was pricing below every standard that's ever been adopted by any federal court, and say you are not committing an antitrust injury. So what is all the to-do about intent? The problem with intent is it is used in this case simply to define what is inherent in competition. If I say to my board of directors, we want to make every sale we possibly can, that is the same thing as saying we want to take every sale we possibly can away from our competitors, and if you do that, they are out of business. So to fashion a test which operates solely upon the intent that is inherent in competition is to penalize competition. And as Mr. Justice Doggett is recorded in the monograph on this act saying time and again, it is that this act is for the benefit of the little man who gets the benefit of these prices, and it is to be consistent with federal law. What has happened in federal law is recognizing that intent is a very elusive mistress in this game, that it simply cannot you cannot look at intent and separate whether the driving force behind price cuts or pricing in general produces the anti-competitive injury. It has been to formulate a test which draws a line in the sand and says there must at least be some threshold relative to an appropriate measure of cost that is crossed before intent becomes a factor. That's the role for this court. We can try to provide help on that. We have done so by telling you what the Fifth Circuit test is, what the Ninth Circuit test is, what other courts are. I'm not so sure, Mr. Justice Doggett, I agree that the Fifth Circuit is a minority test. It's a test which is adopted by the courts, and the Fifth Circuit occupies such a large area that geographically it may be one of the best tests. But that's the policy for this court to draw, looking at the benefit to be gained to the consumer. That's the policy issue in this case. The legal issue in this case is, as Mr. Justice Doggett said twice in the debate, in attempting to make this act consistent with federal law, we've got to adopt some appropriate measure of cost. There was no proof of cost at all in this case, and they recognize that in statements to the jury.
Any questions?
Thank you.
You are within 5 minutes. That concludes the arguments in the second clause, and the court will now take a brief recess.
Thank you.